Before Carole King had hit records of her own, she wrote songs that became hits for other singers. Carole King and her first husband, lyricist Jerry Goffin, were one of the most successful songwriting teams of the 60s. Their other hits included Some Kind of Wonderful, Every Breath I Take, Take Good Care of My Baby, The Locomotion, Chains, Don't Say Nothing Bad, and I'm Into Something Good. In the late 60s, King stepped out from behind the scenes and started writing music and lyrics to perform herself.
So far away, doesn't anybody stay in one place? Be so fine to see your face at my door. Doesn't help to know you're just time away. Long ago.
That's from King's 1971 album Tapestry, which remained on the charts for 6 years and broke the record for best-selling album of all time. None of her subsequent albums have approached the success of Tapestry, and King has somewhat removed herself from the record industry and public life by living on a ranch in Idaho. And Idaho is a long way from Brooklyn, where she grew up. Although she spends much of her time on her ranch, the city is the inspiration for King's new album, City Streets. It's her first record in 5 years. She told me why it's been so long.
I was actually waiting till I got it right. it just took me that long to accumulate a collection of songs that I felt was really worth putting out as an album.
Do you think that there are stylistic changes in this new record?
From the old things?
Yeah.
Definitely. This record is the first time that I've really felt comfortable rocking. I've always wanted to, but, you know, the traditional image of me is the quiet, shy person behind the piano, and I've sort of come out from behind the piano. I play electric guitar now. I'm working with some of the really great rockers on this album, Max Weinberg, Eric Clapton, Steve Ferroni, Eric's drummer, and my co-producer, Rudy Guess, and they all really inspired me to put a little more edge into my work.
You said you were uncomfortable rocking before. What made you uncomfortable with it?
You mean in the old days?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It was like, I don't know what made me uncomfortable, but it was like putting on a new outfit and you're not sure if it looks good on you or not, and you're not really comfortable in it. It took time for me to get comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
playing guitar also helps.
Playing guitar, you're more up in front of the audience instead of sitting behind the piano.
Yeah, and you can use your instrument and move with it instead of sort of being stuck behind it.
Let's play something from the new record. This is City Streets, which is the title track and the song that also has a video. Do you want to say anything about writing this song?
I think it's pretty self-explanatory. I did live and feel and, you know, experience all the things that I'm writing about in this song, so it's very personal for me, and I hope that it's universal for other people.
Let's hear it.
Tides of life are ebbing out.
Carole King, City Streets, from her new album of the same name.
Gee, you cut it off before the Eric Clapton solo. They'll have to go out and buy it now to hear that.
You've actually been living on a farm in Idaho for the past few years, right?
Yeah, it's a ranch, and I've been there for, I don't know, about 8 years.
Why did you give up the city?
Too much stress, I think. I was really ready for a change and a place to recharge and be, you know, around nature, more nature, less people. Mm-hmm. But I found after a while that I missed the people. I kind of need both.
You got your start writing songs for other people. Now that you've been writing songs for yourself for the past couple of decades, is it easy to write for you?
I think in some ways it's harder to write for me. When I'm writing for somebody else, I mentally adopt the persona of that person, or my lyricist does, in the case when I write with Jerry Goffin, or we do it together. You kind of put yourself in the headset that you kind of think the other person is. They may not even be, but it's your perception of them, so it's sort of another dynamic that you can write towards. Whereas when I'm writing for myself, there isn't that extra thing. I'm just sort of writing as it comes out, and in some ways it's good, in other ways it's more difficult.
Well, Carole King, I want to play another record from your new album. The album's called City Streets, and this is your song Down to the Darkness. You wrote music and lyrics for this. And speaking of darkness, I think this is one of the darkest songs you've written.
Yeah, I'm very proud of this one because I normally consider myself a gifted or whatever. I'm good at music, and I always feel like when I write lyrics, they just, it's not something I feel comfortable with saying, yeah, I'm really good at doing that. And this lyric I worked really hard on. I took a lot of time and crafted it and worked with the inspiration that I got for it. So I'm really especially proud of this lyric.
Let's give it a listen. Down to the Darkness from Carole King's new record, City Streets. Were you in that kind of mood when you wrote the record?
The whole record? Or you mean that cut?
No, that cut.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Was it about a relationship you were having? Or?
No, actually, it was somewhat inspired by the movie Blue Velvet, oddly enough.
Huh.
And a lot of times you can write a song by putting yourself in a hypothetical situation just as well as, you know, if it's really happening to you.
Did you write songs before you became a professional songwriter, when you were really young?
I've written some form of song since I was about 4 or 5. I really never wrote lyrics much until Tapestry was the first album that I started really writing lyrics, because Jerry Goffin is such a fine lyricist, and he's who I wrote with all the years when I had hits as a songwriter. I just, you know, didn't feel a need. And then when he and I split up, we didn't write together for a little while, and then we went back to writing together and remain friends. I say split up because it may or may not be well known, but we were married. And so we still write together, and we're still friends. But in the interim period, I sort of learned to write lyrics myself, and I never really considered myself as good as he. And to this day, he is the master at lyrics, but that's what I meant when I said Down to the Darkness. To me, I feel for the first time I actually touched the kind of ability that he has at lyrics.
Were you aware of songwriters when you were growing up? I mean, most kids who grow up listening to pop or to rock and roll know the songs, they know the singers, they know the bands, but they don't necessarily know the songwriters.
Yeah, I was to some extent, not really in the pop world, but I went to a lot of Broadway shows, so I was aware of like Rodgers and Hammerstein and you know, people like that. And then when rock and roll was first being born with Chuck Berry, I was definitely aware of people like him, but he was, you know, the singer of his own songs, Jerry Lee Lewis.
You know, you were talking about Jerry Goffin, who was both your songwriting partner and your husband. There were several teams of couples who wrote lyrics together at around that time. There was Ellie Greenwich and
Jeff Barry
and Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann.
Yeah, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil and Jerry and I were, you know, the best known groups. I guess there were other people that weren't married, but.
Were you friends together, or did you feel competitive with each other?
Both. I actually didn't know Jeff and Ellie real well. We did know Barry and Cynthia worked in the same office as Jerry and I, and we also went out socially together. And we really, really loved each other and still do to this day. But it was highly competitive, and it was, you know, that mixed feeling of like, well, I want to get the next record and not them,
right.
Or we want to get it. But still, when they got it, you would kind of be glad because they almost always, if not always, deserved it.
When you started writing professionally, you and Jerry Goffin were working for, I think, a publishing company that was owned by Don Kirshner, the same Don Kirshner who produced The Monkees and who used to host those late-night rock shows on television.
This is Don Kirshner.
Can you set the scene for us? What was it like to turn out songs in an office building?
Didn't matter where we did it. It was just as easy to do it there as at home. Sometimes easier because, you know, we had the kids at home. But also in the office building, just as often we'd have one of the kids in the room. One of said kids being, of course, Louise Goffin, who has had three albums out on her own.
Mm-hmm.
So she got her training really early and on the spot.
So were there like a whole corridor of offices with pianos in them and songwriters banging out new tunes?
It's by now, you know, it's probably fairly well known, the cubicle situation where we would be in one cubicle and say Man and Wild would be in another cubicle and some other team would be in the third cubicle and we'd hear each other trying to write the same song.
Were you given assignments? You
know, always.
Like, what would an assignment be like?
Well, the Drifters are just coming off a top 10 hit, and we want to get the next one. Donny Kirshner was really motivated and motivating. You know, he was kind of a daddy figure, I guess, and we really wanted to do it for Donny. He just, you know, he just kept us motivated and playing off against each other, and it was really fun. It was very competitive, but it was also fun, and the challenge of writing for new people all the time really honed our skills at writing on assignment, doing demos quickly, professionally, and cheaply. Oh, God, cheaply.
Well, the demos are the records that you'd cut for a group who was going to be recording one of your songs, and the demo would show how it's supposed to sound, you know, the melody, the lyrics,
right.
And everything. What makes a good demo?
I don't know. It just has an energy. In many cases, the sounds were really primitive. The performances were flawed. There were scratchy notes on the vocal and wrong notes on the guitar and all that stuff. And tape hiss, because we kept bouncing. At that time, the demos were monaural, one track. That's all we had. And so we just bounced back and forth. So now some of the demos eventually became records because people were telling Kirshner that the demos were so good that he said, more money to be made. Why don't I put them out? So my demo for Bobby V of It Might As Well Rain Until September became my first solo record in that decade anyway. The others before that were not worth mentioning. And Locomotion by Little Eva was in fact a demo for Dee Dee Sharp. And it's funny, you hear it and you hear the drum thing in the beginning, you know, the roll, and before it you hear this enormous amount of tape hiss from the bouncing back and forth from monaural to monaural. But, you know, I always liked the fact that there were raw and real, and if there were mistakes and tape hiss, it didn't matter because it was happening.
When you were working with other groups, writing songs for them in the 60s, did you usually meet them, the singers and groups that you were writing for?
Not always, but generally, yeah, because we, even if we weren't involved in the production, we'd often go to the sessions. We did.
What would you do if you felt that a singer or a group wasn't putting your song over right?
I don't think it ever happened.
Really?
I imagine if it did, not being shy about communicating my feelings about those kind of things, I probably found a way to let somebody know or make a suggestion. But I don't know. Usually they picked up the energy from the demo, and if anything, took it, way farther. One of the great moments of my life as a songwriter was the first time that I heard Aretha Franklin's version of Natural Woman, which was in many ways not like the demo at all. It was amazing because this was the ultimate singer in the world to me, and she was singing my song, and she had taken what I did with it and did what I never dreamed could be done with it.
And so you were thrilled. Did you for a moment feel like it was no longer your song or something?
Oh, no, okay. Not at all. Uh-huh. It was my song taken to the nth power.
How did you feel recording that song after she did it?
I felt that, the idea of topping it didn't even cross my mind, but I felt that as the songwriter, I had sort of a claim on any version of it I wanted to do, and it would be okay because I wrote it. When I say I, Jerry Goffin also co-wrote that. But it wasn't even a problem in my mind. It was like two very separate things. Nobody could even approach how she sang it, so that wasn't even in my mind.
I think your first really big hit, your first number one hit, was a song you wrote for the Shirelles, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow. What were you keeping in mind when you wrote that song for them, one of the first girl groups?
Well, again, Jerry wrote that lyric. Jerry has written, being a man, he has written some of the best lyrics for women that exist, Natural Woman being one of them, Will You Love Me Tomorrow, another one, and one I didn't write with him, Saving All My Love for You by Whitney Houston. I think he was thinking, he did what I was talking about, he put himself in the mental persona of what it would be like to be a young girl, thinking, yeah, but will you respect me in the morning? And as far as the music went, I had in my mind their previous hit, which was Tonight's the Night, and we always kind of tried to incorporate some of the chordal feeling and the mood and the energy and just kind of write it backwards, upside down, and sideways, and the combination just worked. Also, I've had, when I was growing up, I listened to classical music a lot as well as Broadway. I had a real good background in all kinds of music. Real good exposure, and so I think there's almost a classical feel to that melody and the arrangement with the cellos starting it off.
Mm-hmm. Were you expected to write in different styles for white and black performers?
Again, I don't know about expected, but one followed one's impulses, and if it was a black performer who had done something in a style that was R&B related, chances are what I would write would be related to what they had just done. But there were, crossover type of records where we'd write something for a black artist and a white artist would wind up doing it and vice versa.
I think, in thinking about your body of songs from the 60s, the performer and songs that seem to fit in there the least is Steve Lawrence, songs like Go Away, Little Girl.
You say fit in there the least, it just... We wrote for whoever was sort of thrown at us, and it just sort of shows that we were given a chance to demonstrate versatility, and I guess we had it because we had been exposed, Jerry and I both, to all kinds of music, pop music and R&B and the baby rock and roll records that were just starting to happen in their R&B versions.
Carole King is my guest. You dropped out of college when you were a freshman, I believe, to marry Jerry Goffin, who was also your songwriting partner. Were your parents upset by that?
No, they weren't. But interestingly enough, both my parents have college degrees. And so far, they're the last ones in my family to have that. Neither of my older daughters have a college degree. But they weren't upset. They wanted me to do what worked for me. And I did, in fact, go back and actually complete another year of college.
You were writing hit songs when you were a teenager. When you really outgrew your teenage years, did you find it at all more difficult to write hit songs that younger groups would sing?
No, because I'm a perpetual teenager.
Was it a crisis for you when bands started writing their own songs? I know a lot of songwriters felt shut out in the post-Beatle years.
Yeah, I think that was a problem for us for a while. I think the bigger problem, because there were still people looking for material, but the biggest problem when Bob Dylan and the Beatles came along was not so much that they were self-contained, but that they were so good. They were so raw and so different from, we were a little more polished by that time, having had all our training and, you know, our types of exposure to Broadway and pop music. And these guys were like, you know, out there, raw. So it took us a while to figure out what it is they were doing.
And once you figured out what it is they were doing, did it change your songwriting?
Probably, but I couldn't to this day tell you how.
Mm-hmm. After you and Jerry Goffin broke up, you started writing lyrics to your own songs, and you also started performing. What was it that got you in front of the microphone on stage and in the recording studio?
I don't know. I do know that it seemed inevitable. I did a record called Now That Everything's Been Said with a group called The City, which consisted of Charlie Larkey, my bass player and also second husband, and Danny Korchmar, who is, you know, now a well-known guitar player and producer and writer in his own right. And they just kept egging me on, come on, you can do it. And we never did go on the road with The City. We had we used Jimmy Gordon as a drummer on the record, but we just never did go on the road. But then I met James Taylor and started playing as a backup musician for him. And so I'd find myself on a stage with him. And one night he said, well, why don't you, you know, do one of your songs? And I was terrified. He said, no, it'll be fine. And in the middle of his set, he introduced me to his audience as the woman that had written a lot of their favorite hits. And he was going to turn the stage over to me, and we were good friends and all. And the audience, who loved him, was sort of ready to receive me and pre-liked me. So it was like, well, okay, they're ready to like me. I guess I'll do this. And it just was real easy. I really learned from James that all you have to do is get out there and be yourself and do the song. And, you know, it's okay. It's just the same as playing it for a few friends in a living room as it is for 20,000 people.
Was it stage fright and fear of not being liked that kept you out of performing until then?
Probably. Because I performed songs for people, you know, in a room, a few people at a time. I guess it was just the concept of being in front of all those people.
No, I would imagine that writing songs for so many years and seeing all these great groups and singers record them, that you'd get kind of envious and sometimes wish that it were you on that stage or selling all those records with your voice on it. You never felt envious of them?
I don't know if envious is the right word. Just at a certain point, writing the songs was the main thing. To write the song, to look at this thing and say, I did that, was great. And then getting on stage for me became less of a thing about glamour and glory, which I was actually more uncomfortable with than anything, the glamour and the glory. But it was the concept of, I guess I'm the best person to present my song, or I'm the only person to present my song at this time, or whatever. It just seemed like a way of presenting the song, but to me it was always about the song.
Well, that's interesting. So when groups started doing their own songs, there were less performers to record your songs, and in a way, you had to put them across yourself.
I think that's probably true. At that point, I was working with Lou Adler. I had moved to California, and he was out there. So when I did the album Writer, which was the album before Tapestry, and then the Tapestry album, was just me making more demos, only I was doing them for somebody who was going to put them out there and make them public. And the year the Tapestry came out coincided with the fact that James was going out on tour using me as his backup musician, and he talked me into being one of the opening acts for him. So it just kind of happened. I didn't really think about it.
How do you think your voice has changed since Tapestry?
I think I've gotten better. Years of doing it, practice, I guess. I think I've gotten better and stronger and more confident. I didn't used to consider myself a singer. I would say, well, I'm just the songwriter, but let's turn it over to a real singer. And now I feel that I'm not technically real perfect. And in that regard, I mean, I still look up to people like Barbara Streisand and Whitney Houston as really, and of course Aretha, as real singers. But I feel that I'm also a real singer at this point. I feel that I'm in the league. I'm just not, you know, at that end of the league.
Do you think your voice has gotten a little huskier?
Oh, probably. And I don't even smoke.
Uh-huh. Well, I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you, Carole King.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Terry.